Dear listeners, Sai Rama and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. Welcome to our radio program, Afternoon Satsang. This is a segment of Radio Sai's Thursday Live, hosted by Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai at 12:30 PM Indian Standard Time on Thursdays, only on Asia's stream of Radio Sai Global Harmony. Today's episode was first broadcast live on 3rd September 2015. Have a listen, please.
Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's Afternoon Satsang. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Arvind. As always, we begin by offering our most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet for giving us this opportunity and for giving us such a life where we can think of Swami every day, think of beautiful things that he's doing and he's done and he's continuing to do every moment as we live with him. Before we introduce the topic to you, let me also welcome Arvind. Sai Ram, Arvind.
Sai Ram, Prem. As you said, it is really a wonderful opportunity that we have to think about Swami, read about him, see him. This is something that everyone would love to do. This is something that everyone gets peace by doing. I don't know if it is something that everyone would love to do, as I said, because people who are not aware of the peace and joy that it confers, maybe they are not into it. But once you get addicted to this, this is so beautiful and so fulfilling, and it is really an honor and privilege to have this as our job, so to say. Swami, we are eternally grateful to you for that. We thought that this afternoon satsang, we should definitely speak something about Lord Krishna, because Lord Krishna is a million faceted diamond, if we can call it that way. And in every angle, in every way we view, we see beauty, we see the sparkle, we see a lesson, we see an insight. But more than anything else, we find a lot of joy. So in order to derive that joy, we have decided to dedicate this afternoon satsang in the glories of Lord Krishna.
I don't know whether you've heard of this speaker. Her name is Prema Pandurangan, right?
Ah, yes, I've heard.
She's a very famous Bhagavatam speaker, and she's spoken, I think, a couple of times in Swami's presence during one of the summer courses. She says this very often when she speaks about Bhagavatam. And she says, you know, Rama you can respect. Lord Rama you can look up to. Rama can be worshipped. But to love, you need Krishna. She says, Krishna, you can love because he is part of you. You know, you see the manifestation of all your mischief and all your lightheartedness in him. In fact, he's the embodiment of everything put together. I think in one of the discourses Swami gave, maybe in 2005 or 6 during Janmashtami, Swami said the very stories of Krishna can fill you with joy. It's something which is spontaneously gives joy, and that's what Lord Krishna's life is all about. And as you said, so much filled with the, you know, messages. It's so obvious, and something which somebody was telling once when they were talking about the Ramayana. You know, Ramayana came in a period where people had a little advanced understanding from their intelligence point of view. So that's why most of the lessons were subtle, actually, where you had to look into it to understand what the lessons were. But comparatively, not completely, but comparatively, the lessons in the Krishna Avatar are pretty more obvious than in the Rama Avatar, where, you know, Swami had to go into and say that these stand for the Vedas and this stands for the three gunas and all that. But in the Krishna Avatar, sometimes, you know, it's derived. Lessons are all derived, and the distilled lesson is given to you, where through the Bhagavad Gita very clearly says, you know, what is spirituality? How do you lead a life? How do you follow your dharma? And everything is clearly said. That's why most often we find it so much more easier to relate to Lord Krishna.
In terms of following commands, you know, it makes me think, as we have evolved, you know, as time has passed, they say all animals, including man, is evolving. I feel that while man has evolved in terms of IQ, the IQ has kept growing, the SQ or the spiritual quotient has probably decreased. And that's what even our scriptures say, that from Krita Yuga or Satya Yuga to Kali Yuga, there's a decline in the SQ, spiritual quotient. And probably that is the reason why, if we look at the Satya Yuga, we have so many Amshavatars, the descent of the Lord for a short, a very brief period in time. There is no elaborate birth, growth and nothing like that. You know, if you see Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, Narasimha, Vamana, it is, you know, in the, as the yugas progress and as it becomes more and more difficult to practice spirituality,
right,
that is where the avatars also come in more completeness. In the sense, Krishna is considered as the first Purna avatar. Before that, it's all only parts. So in that sense, how blessed and lucky we are that we have found both Rama and Krishna in our Swami. We have found the gambhiryam of Rama in him and the playfulness and mischief of Krishna in him. It is indeed a blessing, and probably that is the speciality for the Kali Yuga, that though spiritual quotient is the least, it has attracted the most powerful and most beautiful, sweet, charming avatar. You were mentioning as to how the stories of Krishna are beautiful, and I feel it gets even more beautiful when we listen to the same story narrated by Swami in a discourse that Swami gave to all the students at Vrindavan in the dining hall. It was a private discourse. It is recorded in Satya Sai Speaks though. Such a beautiful one. In that, Swami mentions that Krishna's birthday is not according to the solar calendar. It doesn't come every year on the same date. But it comes on the same day when all the celestial positions of the planets and the stars and everything is exactly the same. Because that is how the Indian calendar would mark the birthday. It would mark it based on the repetition of celestial events. So every time that combination comes, that is the day to be celebrated. And that's why we will see many of the Indian festivals do not exactly fall on the same day every year. Deepavali, Krishnashtami, Ganesh Chaturthi, all these depend on this celestial phenomena and are not based on the solar calendar. And Swami says that. So I just feel that it would be wonderful that we go through Krishna's life, Krishna's birth, exactly in the manner that Swami revealed on that beautiful day, the 5th of
September 1977. Very true. Talking about that particular Janmashtami, I think though the Janmashtami fell on 5th of September, the discourse we are talking about was delivered on the 6th of September. Because there is that beautiful incident which some of our teachers who are still with us, you know, who are part of that celebration share with us. Apparently it was the 5th of September, the Janmashtami day, and Swami was not in Vrindavan on that particular day, and they were all celebrating it without Swami's physical presence there. And just as they were celebrating, that evening was going through, they heard the familiar honking of Swami's car, because those days the drivers who used to go with Swami, they had this way of hinting to the boys ahead of time that Swami is coming. I think it's so beautiful to recollect. There used to be a bridge on the way to the Vrindavan ashram when you come from Puttaparthi side.
Yes.
There's a small culvert kind of a bridge which is there.
Correct.
Right. And even as you would come there, there would be a peculiar kind of honking. And that would be a hint to the boys, and boys would come out running. So that's when they came, and Swami came, and then Swami said, oh, today is Janmashtami, but the day is almost over. Let's celebrate it tomorrow. And on that particular day, Swami came to the hostel dining hall, and this discourse which we are referring to was very, very profound discourse and very beautifully detailed discourse Swami gave in the dining hall on the 6th of September.
So 6th of September 1977. And you know, in that Swami begins by talking about the birth of Krishna. It's so beautiful. If you see the Ashtami or the 8th day, you know, we have Saptami, Ashtami, Navami, Dashami. That is how the days are counted. It goes up to 14 days because the lunar calendar has 14 days of the waning phase of the moon, 14 days of the waxing phase of the moon. So accordingly we have Ekadashi, Dwadashi, like that.
Right.
Among these days, the 8th day, the Ashtami day, is considered as unlucky. It's considered as a day on which no new venture is started, nothing, you know, people don't do anything usually on this day. They don't start on a journey on this day. And it is interesting that Lord Krishna chose to be born on such an Ashtami.
And
it shows that where the Lord is concerned, you know, all these rules just wither away. Because the Purnavatar, the most profound, most impact-making avatar, if we can call it that way, took birth on an Ashtami day. And Lord Krishna also happened to be the 8th child for Devaki. And if we see the Dashavatar, the 10 avatars of Vishnu, Lord Krishna happens to be the 8th avatar also. All these combinations of 8. And Swami gives a very profound meaning for this. He says, 8 symbolizes the final step in the Ashtanga Yoga. There's the Ashtanga Yoga, the 8th right. step path to yoga, in which the 8th step is Samadhi. And so Swami says, Krishna symbolizes the ultimate in yoga. That's why he's called Yogishwara, the Lord of Yoga. That is the interpretation and meaning that Swami gives for Krishna being born on Ashtami day as the 8th child, as the 8th avatar.
Interestingly, even as you speak about Ashtami, I remember, when I was a student once, Professor Venkatraman was supposed to speak before Swami's discourse on Janmashtami day.
Okay.
And he made reference to this very fact that, you know, we consider Ashtami as very inauspicious, but Krishna was born on Ashtami, and he, you know, put it forth in a way that the inauspiciousness of Ashtami was removed by the birth of Krishna. Right? And the best part was when Swami followed it up with his discourse, Swami said, you know, Venkatraman said this, but it's not true. Look at Krishna's life. Because he started his avatar on an Ashtami, his life was filled with difficulties. You know, Swami said that, you know, in his childhood, and he was born in a prison and all that, Swami said. The beautiful thing which Swami was saying is, you know, there is no need to be scared of an inauspicious day or inauspicious time, or for that matter, even the difficulties one would face in life. That is what Krishna came to show, that, you know, I went through all these difficulties, but still I came out, you know, the victor in every situation. And that was the message which Swami wanted us to take. You know, don't overlook the troubles which come your way, but realize that you are strong enough to overpower them.
And the word Samadhi, you know, in itself gives us a hint as to how we should do this in a face of troubles or all the obstacles that come in our life. Because Swami says, people think Samadhi means eyes are closed and you are, you know, like almost a comatose stage where you are not doing anything other than just breathing and your heart is beating. But Swami says that is not the meaning of Samadhi. In this Ashtanga Yoga, which starts as Yama, Niyama, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Asana, Dharana, Dhyana and Samadhi. He says this Samadhi is broken into Samadhi, which means equanimity. So Swami says,
right, Dhi means buddhi or intelligence. So Samadhi,
meaning what, right, an intellect which is equanimous.
Balanced and equanimous.
Balanced. And that is what, you know, even in the Gita, Lord Krishna later on says, Sukha dukke same kritva labha labhav jaya jayo. He explains to Arjuna that, Arjuna, the one who is dearest to me is one who is equanimous in the face of sukha and dukha, which is joy and sorrow, labha and alabha, which is gain and loss, jaya jayo, in victory and defeat. So I think, just like Swami says, my life is my message, even Krishna, if you see, he exactly stated this, because while he is preaching everyone to be equanimous, it is not as if he chose a rosy life for himself. He chose apparently the worst kind of circumstances to be born, just to show that if you have equanimity, that's it. Everything gets taken care of, everything gets balanced, and nothing will ever affect you. Krishna definitely practiced what he preached. In fact, that is, as Swami said that day in the discourse, that is the reason why Krishna possibly chose a day like Ashtami, which is bound to give all kind of ill luck and bad fortune to you. He chose such a day just to show that if you have equanimity and take everything in the right spirit, you emerge victorious. You emerge as a Supreme Lord himself.
Right. And Swami goes on to refer to that incident. Of course, we won't go into the details because we presume that most of us know the story of Krishna pretty well, where he's born in the prisons of Mathura, where Kamsa is imprisoned, the parents of Lord Krishna, Vasudeva and Mother Devaki. And that is when, you know, Kamsa is waiting for that 8th child to be born, and because he's been told that this is the child which is going to be his nemesis. So he's waiting for that child to be born. And at that moment, these two parents, mother and father, who are imprisoned in that prison, they are chained. But when this child is born, surprisingly, all the guards are, they kind of blank out and none of them are awake to even listen to this child birth happening. But after the child is born, when Vasudeva picks up this child, the fetters which are binding the Vasudeva just fall away. And he gets this instruction that he's supposed to take this child to Vrindavan across the Yamuna River. But Swami refers to this particular incident and he says that, see, this is very symbolic. When Vasudeva lifted Lord Krishna, when the Lord was embraced, the chains which bound him fell away. This was the message which Lord Krishna was giving at his very birth. That's one point which Swami makes in that discourse.
That's a real beautiful point, you know, and it seems so apt and perfect, and it makes me wonder, why is it that nobody ever thought of this before this discourse when Swami said that? He says that, you know, the minute he picks up Krishna, all the chains fall away. And if we see, when he comes back, he drops Krishna at Gokula and he comes back. When he comes back, the chains come and bind him again, you know. Right. It's almost as if you embrace the Lord and you get Jivan Mukti. You are freed in the true sense. You are liberated even though you reside in the body. And let go of the Lord and you get chained. Not only that, Swami goes on to say in the discourse that as Vasudeva walks, raindrops fall which soften the earth. And he says that the guards who are standing at the prison doors, they are lost in a kind of ecstasy. And therefore, they are totally oblivious to this prisoner walking out comfortably from the prison. At the same time, Swami also says that the river Yamuna parts and gives way for Nanda to walk. Not Nanda, I mean for Vasudeva to walk with Krishna before he can drop it off as Nanda's home. So Swami says that, you know, once you embrace the Lord, not only are you freed, everything works to ensure success for you. The whole universe will conspire to help you to succeed, because the universe is nothing but a slave, a servant to the Lord.
Wait, Robin. I think each avatar has a very, very beautiful way of unfolding. We're fortunate to go through that of Lord Rama, where we saw the different circumstances in which his avatar happens. But again, this is so very beautiful, and it's, you know, so many questions of how the Lord chooses those who will be instrumental in his avatarhood. You know, if he really had to be brought up in Gokula, why wouldn't he be born there? Why should he be born to Mother Devaki and Vasudeva here and be taken there and be brought up there, when he could, even as a child, ward away all the negative forces which try to, you know, kill him as a child? He could have done it even in the prison. I think it's so beautiful that the whole plot is the way it is, and we get a chance to go through it. And so wonderful that after so many years, Swami is here to show us, you know, as we said, the Rama avatar is subtle and the Krishna avatar is not as subtle, but Swami probably sees that even this not so subtle message doesn't seem to be penetrating your head, so let me come and explain it to you.
No, I remember, you know, as you said, when Krishna was born in the prison, he was closest to Kamsa, whom he has come to kill. It would have been the easiest geographically to kill him. But in that sense, he could have killed all the demons by just mere will. But the Lord, always in his compassion and love, he knows that the Bhagavatam is something that will enrapture the listener. That many people will develop love for the Lord because of the Bhagavatam. You know, the Bhagavad Gita is the ultimate spiritual treatise, maybe. But people don't readily get attracted to the Bhagavad Gita, because I think everyone needs a level of evolution before you get attracted to the teachings. The same happens with our own Swami, right? None of us came to Swami saying, wow, have you read Satya Sai Speaks? Oh my God, it is phenomenal. There are a few who have come like that, but most have come pulled, drawn by his beautiful physical form, by the miracles that he does. And I think that is the reason why Krishna also in that avatar does so many things in different manner, kills the demons in different manner, so that we get the joy of recounting all that. And apart from getting the joy, also get important lessons. One more beautiful point that Swami makes in that discourse is, he says, whenever the descent is there, with the Lord always comes the Yoga Maya Shakti. Maya has to come. Maya is a definite characteristic trait of the dual world. And therefore, when that Advaitic Lord descends into the Dvaitic world, he has to come accompanied by Maya. And so Krishna too was accompanied by Maya. And in common parlance, the Lord is known as the Purusha and the Maya is known as the Prakriti, or the female aspect. And Swami says that as Krishna took birth in the prison cell, at the same time Yoga Maya also took birth at Gokula, to the wife of Nanda. And so Vasudeva goes to Gokula exchanges the baby, puts Krishna there, picks up Yogamaya and comes. And Swami says, Yogamaya immediately performs her duty. How? As soon as she comes, she begins to wail. All the guards are trance of bliss is broken. Nature suddenly becomes still again. And they go and notify and it becomes, you know, horrific. Again here, you know, you can understand what Maya does. Maya hides you from the bliss of the Lord. But Maya is a trait of the Lord. And it is Yogamaya who hurries Kamsa towards his doom, because Kamsa comes, picks up this and thinks this is the eighth child and throws it. But the child escapes and says, the one who is going to kill you is still there, Kamsa. Yogamaya is like the fun aspect, you know. It doesn't want to leave Kamsa just like that. Let me ruin his sleep some more. So just tell Kamsa, hey Kamsa, you think you're killing me? I'm not dead, okay? Because I'm not the child supposed to kill you. The child supposed to kill you is already safe, growing far away. I think it's the way we see it. Yogamaya is something that blocks our vision from seeing the true aspect of the Lord. At the same time, it is that which helps us enjoy the mischief and enjoy the humanness of the Lord. So this also Swami points out in that discourse, that Yogamaya always accompanies the Lord.
And of course, many things which Swami says there, probably we'll come to one more interesting part which Swami says in that. Swami talks about, you know, when an avatar comes, what is the purpose he comes in? You know, Krishna did not come with his conch and Sudarshana Chakra, that's what Swami says. In fact, one interesting thing, probably not in this discourse, Swami says some other time is when Shishupala is being killed, where every time he would narrate this incident, he would say that Krishna did not use the Sudarshana Chakra. He takes one of the plates which is there on Tambula and plate. He chops the head of Shishupala with that. So that's one thing which Swami says, that he did not come with his weapons, he did not come with his paraphernalia. Because the Lord comes so that you can relate to him. He comes to give joy, he comes to, you know, become a part of your life and be one with you and give you that joy of communion with him. And Swami went on to say that that's exactly what Krishna did. But unfortunately people picturize him as, you know, wearing a crown and being bejeweled and all that. Swami said he was a simple cowherd boy. And at that instant, during this discourse, Swami looked at the boys and said, one of you give me a towel. And our Shivashankar Sai, sir, who shared with us part of the story.
The former warden
of the Parthi campus, right now the
HOD,
HOD of the physics department. He ran and he brought a long white towel. And Swami tied the towel around his head, and there's a beautiful picture of that. And Swami said, this is how Krishna wore his turban. He did not have a crown or, you know, started jewel on his head. He just wore this simple turban. And there used to be a lot of peacocks around in Vrindavan those days. And he used
just to, like in Vrindavan here.
Right, just in Vrindavan here. And he used to just pick up a few feathers which have fallen down for the animal activists. Krishna never plucked the feathers. Swami said that he would pick up feathers, you know, scattered around, and he would tuck it in that turban. That was one beautiful incident which happened. It really is, when we talk about Vrindavan as it stands today, it really played the role of Vrindavan of Krishna's time, isn't it?
Exactly. You
know, there's no end to the amount of stories we can narrate about our Vrindavan, which is in no way less than the Vrindavan we are talking about in Krishna's time.
In fact, it is because of our experience at our Vrindavan that we are able to appreciate better the leelas of Krishna in his Vrindavan. Dear listeners, we will take a short break now. After the break, we will delve into the subject proper. It often happens that we get so lost in our introduction that the introduction becomes quite lengthy. And it is very important that we know the significance of Krishna's birth and what Swami has spoken about it. After the break, we will take up an interesting theme, which is we will pick up pairs which are very, very, very similar in many ways and yet so different in the way their lives panned out because of the attitude they bore towards Krishna, because of their own ego or because of their own humility. That is definitely going to be interesting. We found it so interesting preparing for this. I'm sure that all of you too will enjoy it. So don't go away anywhere. After this little break, we will go into four such devotee pairs.
Sir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are about to begin a very beautiful detailed study of some of the devotees and some of the characters which occur in the life of Lord Krishna. The idea, as always, is to look at this and see how we can approach our Swami better. We can see what is it that some of these people have done right, what is it that they've got right in their approach to the Lord, and if we could emulate that, that would of course definitely be the underlying idea of this whole process of going through this. Probably we should start right from the birth, you know, because as we said, though Krishna was born to Mother Devaki, we all almost spontaneously think of Mother Yashoda as the mother of Lord Krishna. So here was this one character who was not the mother of Lord Krishna, but who became the mother of Lord Krishna. And there was another character who also had a similar opportunity, that is of the demon or demoness Putana. She comes and she has the opportunity to mother, or rather suckle, Lord Krishna when he was a little child for those few moments. And we were not able to find anything about Mother Yashoda's past, how she landed this, you know, grand opportunity of being the mother of Lord Krishna. But there is a little bit of Putana's past in many of the Puranas.
In the Garga Samhita, which is a work on the life of Krishna, as well as the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, it is written that in her previous birth, Putana was Ratnamala, the daughter of Bali Chakravarti. And Ratnamala was the daughter of King Bali, and it is said that when she saw Vamanavatar, when she saw Lord Vamana, the tiny little boy, the attraction she felt was immediate and intense. Her motherly instinct got aroused so strongly, and you know, it is said many times, it has been said that once a woman becomes a mother, not just her baby, any baby's cry makes her secrete milk. It so happens like that. Even scientifically, it's a known thing. Even when she's at that stage in life, when she has to breastfeed and suckle the baby, say the first few months of the baby's life, in that time, any such cry makes her exude milk. I feel that is possibly the reason why we have this term called the milk of human kindness. Mm-hmm. You know, so it is said that when this Ratnamala saw Vamana, such was the motherly instinct that arose in her. She just felt how wonderful it would be if I have a child like this, you know. And it is in order to fulfill this strong, intense desire of hers that she got the opportunity to actually breastfeed the Lord. But then, you know, later on when she sees what Vamana does to her own father, if you don't know the spiritual significance, if we don't know the background, if we directly look, what actually Vamana does is grows to a huge size and cruelly tramples onto the head of Bali Chakravarti, sending him to the netherworld for eons. Seeing that, she gets very, very angry. And the same person who just felt that she should mother Vamana, she begins to feel that she wants to murder Vamana. And it is said that Krishna knew these because being the Supreme Lord, and therefore he allowed her to fulfill both these desires, to suckle him as well as attempt to take his life when she came in her other birth as Putana.
Right, and that is when she has this opportunity to do both, as you said, in a way. One of the people whom Kamsa sends forth to kill this child, Krishna, is this Putana, because he comes to know that the child is just born and it must be a toddler still. So she sends forth this Putana, and I think the description according to the Bhagavatam is she claims that she is something like a midwife who has this blessing to confer nutrition and health on any child that she gets an opportunity to suckle. And that's how she comes to Mother Yashoda and says that, you know, you were very old when this child was born to you, and there's a possibility that your milk does not give enough nourishment to your child, and let me do this for this little child. And that's what Swami says, I think, even in this discourse we were referring to. Swami describes that dialogue which Putana says, and so immediately Mother Yashoda gives the child to her, and when she comes with poison smeared on her breast, thinking that when she feeds this child, she would, you know, poison the child in the process. But apparently when Lord Krishna starts suckling, you know, from Putana, she realizes that this child is not going to be killed by her. And I think Swami says that when she embraces Krishna, she realizes that this child is not an ordinary child. He cannot be killed by her. And she also knows that, you know, it almost flashes in front of her that her destiny is in front of her, as she is not going to be killing this child, but rather this child is going to suck the life out of her. And she very willingly offers herself to him, thinking very, very gleefully, almost like what we spoke about Maricha when we spoke about the Ramayana, where, you know, she says that what a beautiful destiny awaits me, because this child is not only going to drink milk from me, but is going to suck the life out of me. And she offers herself to Krishna.
Well, Yashoda's past we may not know, but her future, ever since Krishna came, totally changed. We know how blessed she was. She got the chance to mother Krishna, and she also got the blessed opportunity to realize who Krishna was. When Krishna put mud into his mouth and he's eating, and she says, "Open it, I want to take out the mud." When Krishna opens his mouth, she sees the entire creation, the cosmos, and she has that Vishwarupa Darshana, and she just goes into a faint. She grows into, from mothering Krishna, she grows into a friend for Krishna. In fact, she later becomes like the Gopikas. She also enjoys the pranks and everything of Krishna. She becomes so possessive of Krishna also. In fact, she keeps saying, "Krishna, why do you go to other Gopikas' homes and break pots to steal butter? I'll give you all the butter there is at home. Is there not sufficient butter at home?" In fact, Nanda, who is the husband of Yashoda, happens to be the village chieftain also. He is the head of the village. He is also the most prosperous man in the village. So he has all the butter and curd at home, and yet Mother Yashoda says, why do you go? Please accept my butter. You know, later we know how Swami sings the bhajan Chitta Chora Yashoda Ke Baal, and there he says that Navanita, or that butter, is not just butter, it is the devotee's heart. And Krishna has come to steal the heart of every devotee, not just one. But that pining for Krishna to accept her heart was there throughout her life in Mother Yashoda. It is a great separation that she endured. You know, she did not get merger in him just so quickly the way Putana got. She had to endure separation, physical separation from him. But she was able to endure it because she internalized Krishna. Krishna had become a part of her, just like any other Gopika did it. And I feel when we see these two devotees, Putana and Yashoda, it becomes very, very clear that though the physical attraction to the Lord, even Yashoda was attracted to the baby. So beautiful, so bonny, so charming. In fact, that is why he has been named as Krishna also, because Karshayati iti Krishnaha. Karshayati means one who attracts. Anybody who sees Krishna gets attracted to him. That was the attraction. So there will be a physical attraction when the Lord descends. But Mother Yashoda's life teaches us that we have to transcend that physical attraction and foster it into a deep love, so that we don't fall into the trap of Maya that Putana briefly fell into.
And we spoke about Maya, you mentioned about Maya, but if you see, you know, Swami has also said it on other occasions, that even this Maya can be put to a beneficial use if the person who is using it has the focus on the Lord. I think that's perfectly true when it comes to Yashoda. Though she had the vision of the cosmos in Krishna's mouth, She had the experience where she was trying to tie Krishna and she was not able to, no length of rope was enough to bind him. All these were affirmations to the hint that she had that this was not an ordinary child. But as Swami would say, that every time Krishna would erase the memory of Yashoda of such incidents, so that she could relate to Krishna as her own child. Because all said and done, maybe, you know, the way we relate to God in a worldly level somehow has a stronger pull for, you know, than for most of us, than we would when we look at God as, oh, he is almighty, oh, he's the creator. And that's why, you know, Swami also would often do that. You know, he would come and he would cry with us, he would laugh with us, he would, you know, he would share the fear we had, you know, be it an exam or be it before we, you know, are in the beginning of a venture.
Even, why go that far? Even before we had to give a public speech, in his very presence.
Right.
He would comfort.
Right. And he would share that anxiety. You know, that is the beautiful thing. I remember when Swami was training a few boys for the talks which used to happen during Dashara. You know, Swami had physically trained each one of them. Swami would ask them to repeat that speech over and over again. And the day before the speeches were supposed to begin, Swami was telling, you know, I am confident of all of you, but I am very tensed about this boy, because he was the most tensed boy. And Swami was telling, I am very tensed about this boy, I hope he does well, you know, he should do well. He was almost sharing our care, you know, thing, because he wanted us to come and tell him that, Swami, this is my worry, this is what I'm scared of, this is what I'm happy of, this is my achievement, and this is what I want to conquer. And I think literally that is what Swami showed through the life of Mother Yashoda, because he said even that Maya could be put to best use. She thought of Krishna always as her son, but that attachment actually brought about her redemption. And the other beautiful comparison which we can bring out from this is, you know, one thing, of course, is you have to be very, very careful of what you desire for when you're in the Lord's presence. Because both the prayers which she made, which probably could not be even spoken of as a prayer. You know, when you spoke of Ratnamala, when she felt, it was not even a prayer, it was just a feeling, a spontaneous,
intense desire, right,
outpouring from the heart. And that gets answered. So we'll have to be really, really careful when we believe that when we pray to Swami, when we take Swami's name in the bhajan, Swami manifests himself. We have to be very, very careful of what we ask for in Swami's presence. And I think that is one thing which really stands out from the episode of Putana.
Perfectly, because, you know, it is often said, be careful what you ask for, in the sense that the way generally you feel is, be careful what you ask for, because if it's some wrong thing, God will not fulfill. But seeing this, it becomes very emphatically clear that be careful what you ask for, because whatever you ask for, you will be given. But you probably will be given at a time when you realize how foolish it was that I asked. That is why Swami says, just shut up, don't ask for anything, because what is best will be conferred on you anyways.
Just recollect, one of the old students were once sharing with us that he was going through that period when Swami was ignoring him and, you know, Swami was not talking to him. He was so upset with Swami that he wrote a letter to Swami in which he said, Swami, the coldest deserts of Siberia are not colder than you. The treatment which you're giving to me is so cold. And of course, things changed and he graduated, he went on and he was working abroad. When for some reason, I think probably in a vacation or something, he was actually much later stuck in a desert in Siberia.
Where,
you know, he was feeling very lonely. It was snowing. It was a snowstorm. Of course, he was safe. There's no nothing about that. But at that very moment, he recollected this letter that he had written to Swami. That, you know, and he said that, you know, when in that moment when he was, because it's very depressing to be in a situation like that when it's so cold and when you're alone in a foreign country. He said, spontaneously, I was thinking of Swami and I was praying to Swami. And that time I realized that, you know, nothing could be more warm than Swami's presence. Nothing could be more warm than Swami's love, even when he is ignoring.
Exactly.
And, you know, probably that is what it is. When you're in Swami's presence, you have to be really careful of what you're thinking in your mind.
I don't think he would have even dreamt that a simile that he used or a metaphor that he used would get transformed literally into his own life. So, dear listeners, this is time for yet another break. We have finished one devotee pair. As I said, we have got three more devotee pairs coming up after this break.
Yennattavam sedane Yennattavam sedane Yashoda Yennattavam sedane Yashoda Yennattavam sedane Yashoda Ingum nirai parabrahmam Amma vendraka 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 Yennattavam sedane Yashoda Eeru bhuvanangal padithavanai Eeru bhuvanangal padithavanai Kayilendi siraati paaluti Kayilendi siraati paaluti Chalaattu ennattavam sedane Kayilendi siraati paaluti Chalaattu ennattavam sedane Yashoda Ingum nirai parabrahmam Amma vendraka Yennattavam sedane Yashoda Sanakadiya Tava yogam seidu Sanakadiya Tava yogam seidu Varunti sadi sadai Punitamagi Elivil pera Yennattavam sedane Yashoda Ingum nirai Parabrahmam Amma vendraka Yennattavam sedane பிரம்மனும் இந்திரனும் முரலில் கட்டி வாய்ப்பொத்தி கெஞ்ச வைத்தார் கண்ணனை உரலில் கட்டி வாய்ப்பொத்தி கெஞ்ச வைத்தார் கண்ணனை உரலில் கட்டி வாய்ப்பொத்தி கெஞ்ச வைத்தாய் கண்ணனை உரலில் கட்டி வாய்ப்பொத்தி கெஞ்ச வைத்தாய் தாயே என்ன தவம் செய்தனே யசோதா எங்கும் நிறை பரபிரம்மம் அம்மா வென்றழைக்க என்ன தவம் செய்தனே என்ன தவம் செய்தனே என்ன தவம் செய்தனே யசோதா
Welcome back, dear listeners, and our lessons and insights from the lives of devotees of Lord Krishna, people who loved Krishna, continues. The next pair that we take up are two people, both of whom were cousin brothers to Krishna, in the sense that their mother and Krishna's father were brothers and sisters. I am referring to Karna and Arjuna. Of course, when we go through the Mahabharata, the story of Karna is having it's a roller coaster ride. So it doesn't become evident to Karna or the Pandavas in the beginning that Karna is their own elder brother. But Karna is definitely one among the Pandavas. He is the eldest son of Kunti. And Arjuna is the third son of Kunti, the second being Yudhishthira. Both Arjuna and Karna have great regard for Krishna. Know that he is the supreme one. There is no doubt in that. Now Karna also knows Krishna is supreme. Arjuna also knows Krishna is supreme. And yet, the way their lives panned out is totally different. And I think this will be another interesting devotee pair that we can discuss.
Very true. They're really very similar but so different, because talent-wise, they were the two characters who were comparable. At the same time, you know, there are some differences in the two. Maybe the history part of the two characters, you can take it up. I mean, if you look at the characters, one thing which stands out with Arjuna is the whole Bhagavad Gita was given because at the point when he had to go and take the battle, all said and done, he was ready to give it up. What was his right? He was ready to give it up. And he said, what is there? I mean, after all, at the end of it, you know, somebody is going to rule and somebody is going to be happy. Let's give it up. But if you look at Karna, his whole journey started because he felt that his talent was not being recognized. You know, he was fighting for his due in a sense. Because if you critically look at the two characters, in a sense, Karna was actually pushing himself ahead of everything else. And when somebody was there to patronize him, when, you know, Duryodhana came and gave him that kingdom and said, you know, I will be your friend and I will give you the place of honor which you deserve, he became so, I mean, he
indebted to,
thank you for that word. He felt so indebted to Duryodhana that he had to place that friendship above all else, even above dharma.
Placing it above dharma, you know, might be slightly justified in the sense that, you know, you can say that maybe he was in a dharma sankat. He was in a kind of a confusion, a moral dilemma as to which is higher. But what is unforgivable about Karna, and probably this made all the difference, was, you see, when it came to listening to Lord Krishna, he did not do that also. You see, just before the war took place, Krishna actually goes to Karna. Before we go into that, this is a famous episode that Swami has often narrated. We need not go into it, but we know how Arjuna, without even blinking or batting his eyelids, he agreed when Krishna said it's a eagle flying out there or it's a crow flying out there. And Arjuna said, yes, yes, O Krishna, it is indeed an eagle. Yes, it is indeed a crow. And Krishna says, Arjuna, are you blind? What is it so foolishly you are agreeing to whatever I say? What do you think it is? And Arjuna says, Lord, I trust your word more than what I trust my own eyesight. So therefore, there is no doubt in that. You know, whatever you say is the ultimate, and that is what I accept. Well, that was Arjuna's attitude. If we look at Karna, you know, Krishna goes and tells Karna. This is at a time when Karna has already done many misdeeds. When the Pandavas are in exile, on Duryodhana's command, Karna goes and tries to tease and molest the Pandavas. He gets caught, and it's Yudhishthira sends Arjuna to save him. That's another story. But also when, you know, Draupadi is being dishonored in court, Karna gets up and tells she's worse than a prostitute. You know, that is how he criticizes her. So he has done so many things which are adharmic, actually. And yet, the Lord, seeing his positives, he has many positives, seeing his positives and seeing his love for Krishna. There are many episodes where Krishna himself shows Arjuna how great Karna's love for him is and how great Karna's qualities are. Whether it is charity, whether it is his courage, bravery, and you know, how he keeps up his word. All this is there. And that's why Krishna goes and tells Karna that, do you know, Karna, that you are the eldest among Pandavas? And Karna says, yes, I know. He knows it. He's aware of it. He says, but Krishna, why are you bringing it up now? And Krishna says, because, you know, you don't know how this war is going to end. It might end with the Pandavas being victorious. And at that time, if they tell, be the king, what will you do? How will you be able to rule over your brothers against whom you're fighting? Karna says, no way that is going to happen. Because if the Pandavas win, then I won't be alive. And he says that between Arjuna and Karna, only one can live, because if the Pandavas win, that means Arjuna is living and I am dead. Because as long as I am alive, the Pandavas can't win. You know, that statement in itself shows delusion, because if Krishna is on Pandava's side, how can it be said that as long as I am alive, the Pandavas can't win? By that very statement, Karna seems to have written his death warrant. So, though in every way, physically, skill-wise, and even in terms of the good qualities, noble virtues, Karna was equal to, if not greater than Arjuna, when it came to the vital test of choosing God or the world, Karna seemed to have chosen wrongly. That has made all the difference in their lives.
Exactly. In fact, one episode which I think Swami himself would narrate many times is when Mother Gandhari comes and asks Krishna. He says, you know, my children, the Kauravas, are related to you the same way Kunti's children are related to you. Why are you siding by them? And she knows that the side which Krishna takes is definitely going to be victorious. And she says, when, you know, relation-wise they're equals, why is it that you choose them? And one thing which Krishna says is, of course, that, you know, I am not in the side of one cousin or the other. I am in the side of Dharma always. And see the difference between your children and the Pandavas. You know, the Pandavas always prioritize Dharma and the welfare of others. And more importantly, me and my command ahead of their own welfare. But here are your children. At all times, they're only thinking about themselves. And what is spared after them is given to in the subjects. And the last position is given to God. So it is not me making a choice. It is your children who made the choice. I think that is really the difference even between Karna and Arjuna, between Pandavas and the Kauravas.
You know, this point that you make is very valid, because it shows that the Lord has no preferences and priorities. It is by our own attitudes and actions that we shape. Karna is often extolled by many as a great hero, a tragic hero, a hero who deserved better. But if we look at Karna's past, you know, it is said that in his previous birth, he was the king Dambodbhava, who wanted to become immortal. You know, in his quest for immortality, he prays to Lord Surya, who comes and tells him that, you know, immortality is, you can't. Once you have life, there's supposed to be death. So you can't be immortal. Then he says, okay, then let it be that, let me be protected by 1,000 armors. As long as these armors are on me, death should not approach me. That's all. So Surya grants that. And then he makes the further addendums. He says, in order to break one armor, a person who has done penance like me for 1,000 years, he alone should have the capacity to break an armor. So that boon is also granted. And then he says, once the armor shatters, whoever shatters it must die immediately. And because of this, because he has 1,000 armors, Dambodbhava is also named as Sahasra Kavacha, meaning one of 1,000 armors. And this is his way of thinking that now I'm immortal, now nothing can touch me. Though Surya told me that I can't make you immortal, the sun god told me I can't make you immortal, I have fooled him in such a manner that I'm as good as immortal. Because even if somebody does 1,000 year penance and manages to break just one of my 1,000 sheets, he will die after that and there will be no more like that. What is the probability of having 1,000 such people being born?
Right.
But these are the loopholes that humans foolishly make in Maya. And the Lord exploits. It is said that as the children of a Murti, the daughter of Daksha, whose other daughter is Parvati actually. Murti is one daughter. Okay. And Dharma, who is supposed to be the son of Brahma. He's called a Manasa Putra because he is said to have been born from the mind of Brahma.
Right.
As their children are born, twins called Nara and Narayana. Very interesting the name, because Nara means man, Narayana is the Lord, but they are called Nara Narayana, these sages, and they do a lot of penance, and as they grow up they see that this Sahasra Kavach is bothering all the people in the region because he has become very egoistic and proud about his prowess. So then what happens is Nara goes and challenges Sahasra Kavach. His twin brother Narayana, what Sahasra Kavach doesn't realize at that time is that Nara and Narayana are like two bodies with a single soul. Narayana sits in penance, meditating and supplying power to Nara, while Nara battles Sahasra Kavach. After 1,000 years of battle, it is said that along with, you know, doing the penance, Narayana is also chanting the Mahamrityunjaya mantra, Trayambakam Yajamahe, which is supposed to grant you freedom from death. So when he does this for 1,000 years, as Nara fights Sahasra Kavach, he breaks one shield, one armor, and he dies immediately because of the Mrityunjaya mantra, the penance of Narayana. Nara is revived to life. And as soon as he is revived to life, the weapons of Nara are picked up by Narayana and he begins to combat Sahasra Kavach. In the meanwhile, Nara goes and sits in penance. In this manner, by taking alternative turns, throughout the Treta Yuga they fight and demolish 999 armors of Sahasra Kavach. One armor is left, he goes and takes refuge under Surya. And Surya, the sun god, hides him and tells Nara and Narayana that, see, though you might be behind him, though he might be wicked, he has taken refuge under me, I can't. Now this is something that is wrong on the part of a sun god, because he is going against Narayana. And it is said, therefore, because of that attachment, the sun god becomes father to Karna. And Karna, they say, is evil because of his Sahasra Kavach tendencies, but he is noble because of the tendencies that he has derived from the sun god. After all, he is the son of sun god. And therefore, Karna is this kind of a very different character in the Mahabharata, where you don't know whether you want to cry for him or whether you want to laugh at his fate. It's very difficult. He is a tragic hero because of the combination of these two things, demon and sun god. And that he is born with that final armor, you know, the Kavacha, which we will not go into that story now, but Indra comes and removes it off him. And Nara is born as Arjuna, Narayana is Krishna, and Nara and Narayana complete their task by killing Karna.
So really fascinating, isn't it, the story? But you know, the end of the day, the straightforward lesson is, if you look at Arjuna, he was not a flawless character. You know, though we speak of him as the hero, as a great warrior, as we said, in comparison, you know, their talent is comparable. But the thing is, you know, he also was not free of doubts. He also had situations where he questioned actions of Krishna. You know, we speak of him on one hand where he had complete surrender. Swami himself extols him for that. On the other hand, there are also situations where he questions the acts of Krishna and all that. But the thing was, always at the end of the day, you know, there were arguments, there were questions, there were doubts, but he was always ready to accept the word of Krishna as final and supreme. Mm-hmm. Even though, probably in the back of his mind, he was feeling that this will bring me ill repute as a warrior, this will bring me ill repute as a person. But so what? I have to do what is told to me. And that prioritization is what actually makes a hero out of an ordinary individual. I think that is the greatest lesson for all of us. Probably we'll just play one small clip where in a discourse, Swami clearly says this is the difference which really made the Pandavas stand out.
This is the difference not only between Arjuna and Karna, but between the Pandavas and Kauravas themselves.
You know, the Kauravas have got the wealth full of
that money.
Pandavas didn't have any single paisa.
They
spent their time in the forest partaking the leaves
there.
What happened ultimately? And Pandavas could have Krishna by
the and
Kauravas sinned
ultimately.
What is the use of all the wealth?
కానీ ధనం పైన పండుకున్నప్పటికీ
వన్ మే రెస్ట్ ఆన్ వే
మనీ ధృతరాష్ట్రుడు ఒక అగ్నిమిజీని పైన పవడించినట్టుగా ఉంటుంది.
దో ధృతరాష్ట్ర వాజ్ లయింగ్ ఆన్ ద బెడ్ ఆఫ్ మనీ, ఇట్ వాజ్ సంథింగ్ లైక్ ఎ బెడ్ ఆఫ్ ఫైర్. పరుణి
ఆప్సతూలికా పాన్పు.
And in fact, he was resting in a comfortable
కానీ అది అగ్ని పరివితంగా మారిపోయింది.
But it has become a bed of fire.
పాండవులు అరణ్యములో జీవిస్తూ వచ్చారు.
పాండవ స్పెండ్ దేర్ టైం ఇన్ ద ఫారెస్ట్.
ఆ జీవితాన్ని గడుపుతూ వచ్చారు.
దే వర్ సో హ్యాపీ ఇన్ ది లైఫ్.
ఏంటా హాయి జీవితము? కృష్ణనామమే హాయి జీవితము.
హౌ ఆర్ దే హ్యాపీ దేర్ ఇన్ ద ఫారెస్ట్ బికాజ్ దే రిసైటెడ్ నేమ్ ఆఫ్ కృష్ణ.
కనుకనే పాండవులకును కౌరవులకు ఉండేటువంటి వ్యత్యాసం కొంత మీరు గుర్తించాలి.
అండర్స్టాండ్ ద డిఫరెన్స్ బిట్వీన్ పాండవస్ అండ్ కౌరవస్.
పాండవులు ఫస్ట్ గాడ్.
పాండవస్ హస్ టేకెన్ గాడ్ ఇన్ ద ఫస్ట్ ప్లేస్.
నెక్స్ట్ వరల్డ్
కన్సిడర్డ్ వరల్డ్
లాస్ట్ ఐ.
And the last, the individual. They consider themselves in the last.
Kauravas
are not like that.
First Nenu.
First I. Next world.
Last God.
Last they kept God.
అందువల్లనే వాడు సర్వవిధంలో నాశనానికి గురి అయిపోయారు.
దేర్ఫోర్ దే హావ్ రూయిన్డ్ దెంసెల్వ్స్ ఇన్ ఎవ్రీ
మొట్టమొదట మనకు దైవం కావాలి.
ఫస్ట్ వీ నీడ్ గాడ్.
దైవమే లేకపోతే ఎన్ని ఉండి ప్రయోజనం ఏమిటి?
వితౌట్ గాడ్ వాట్ ఇస్ ద ఫన్ ఆఫ్ హావింగ్
మనీ? కమ్స్ అండ్ గోస్. మొరాలిటీ కమ్స్ అండ్ గ్రోస్.
Money comes and goes, morality comes and grows.
ఆ మొరాలిటీ లేనప్పుడు ఈ మనీ ఉండి ప్రయోజనం ఏమిటి?
Without morality, what is the use of
ఉండి ప్రయోజనం ఏమిటి?
What is the use of all?
మలమూత్ర దుర్గంధ మాంసరక్తమే కానీ పురుగు జవ్వాజీలు పుట్టబోవు.
The body is full of the fecal matter and the urine and the foul smell, not a fragrance or aroma.
నిమిష నిమిషములకు నీటి ఊరినే కానీ పురుగు జవ్వాజీలు పుట్టబోవు.
It is only the foul smell that emits out of the body, not the scents and aroma.
ఏమిటి ఈ దేహం?
What is this body?
మలమూత్ర దుర్గంధ మాంసరక్తంతో కూడినటువంటిది.
It is full of the flesh and the bone and the urine.
ఈ మాంసరక్తంతో కూడినటువంటి దానికి ఇంకొక మాంసరక్తం మనకి ఎందుకు?
When this is full of the flesh and the blood and the
bone. దీనిని సాత్వికం చేసుకో.
Make yourself sacred.
దీనిని పవిత్రం చేసుకో.
Make yourself sacred.
దీనిని సరియైనటువంటి ఒక జన్మను అనుభవించు.
And enjoy the life in the proper way.
Well, it can't get more emphatic than that. Nothing to add. As Swami was speaking so powerfully and said that the only difference between these two is that they made God their priority. I remember Swami saying in a discourse that everybody should always place God as first priority, and that is what even Sai stands for. S-A-I. Sai first, all others next, I last. And Swami punned on this and joked on this saying, but today in the world nobody wants Sai, everyone wants IAS. IAS is a high post, the Indian Administrative Service. You know, everybody wants to join that because that is lucrative. It is a steady income, it is safe, it gives you your authority and gives you control over people. So Swami joked like that saying that the priority has been reversed today. It has become I first, all others next, Sai last. So this pair of Arjuna, Karna show that God has to be given top priority. A similar such pairing we can do, possibly not between two people, but between two groups of people. The two groups that we are speaking about are the Yadavas, that is Krishna's family, direct family into which he was born, and the Gopikas. The commonality between these two groups is both of them got the opportunity to be physically very close to Krishna. The Gopikas enjoyed Krishna's physical proximity, so did the Yadavas. They could claim of being in the same family as Krishna. And yet, the fate of the Yadavas we know, they killed themselves in the Mausala Parva of the Puranas. It is mentioned, in the Mahabharata I mean, the Mausala Parva, it is mentioned how the Yadavas hit each other with iron pestles and killed themselves, and the whole city of Dwarka was swallowed by the sea. And that is how Lord Krishna chooses to give up his avatarhood. But the Gopikas, even to this day, I don't know if we sing about the glories of the Yadavas and their devotion to Krishna, though they were physically so close to Krishna, but the Gopikas are legends today. And though we don't know the name of each Gopika, we definitely strive to become like Gopikas to our own Lord Swami, to our dear Swami. I feel this is another interesting pair which we can compare and contrast, where both had great physical proximity to Krishna and yet their ends differed so much.
True, because in a sense you can say the Yadavas were also devotees in a sense, because they also had that kind of love when they looked up to Krishna as their, you know, main person of their clan or whatever it is. But just that little difference of, you know, he belongs to us and we belong to him, as Swami would put it. In fact, that is what Swami would tell when Krishna was leaving Gokul and or Vrindavan, I mean, to Mathura. All the Gopikas come running to Radha and say that, you know, Krishna is going away, Krishna is leaving. And they tell her that, see, if you tell, he will stop. So only you are the best person, come and stop him. And that's when Radha actually infuses this feeling, which is, you know, verily the part of her, to the other Gopikas. She says, see, we have to understand that we belong to Krishna. Krishna does not belong to us. Probably if we go and tell him, he will stop. But that would mean that we are trying to lay claim over Krishna and his life. On the other hand, actually we belong to Krishna, and we are like, you know, she gives a very beautiful analogy where she shows a puddle of water and she says, look, you can see the reflection of the moon in that. But this puddle cannot claim that the moon is its own.
Beautiful.
The puddle can only be happy that, you know, this beautiful moon chose to reflect itself on us. And we should live our life with gratitude and, you know, with a sense of belonging. And that's exactly what is the difference between the Gopikas and the Yadavas. Because the Yadavas would often say that, you know, he is our Krishna, he is our Krishna, he is, you know, our, the Lord who is born in our clan. And that actually led to a lot of ego and, as you said, led to their destruction in the end. But the Gopikas are eternal, because we cannot think of, you know, the beautiful time that Krishna spent. No Bhagavatam is complete without the mention of the Gopikas and Radhas. And it is just this difference that we belong to him.
We belong to him is what the Gopikas thought. He belongs to us is what the Yadavas thought. And as you said, that has made all the difference. Because while the Yadavas got nearness, you know, after Krishna left Vrindavan, he went to Mathura. He became distanced from the Gopikas. Physically, he was so far away. After that, he even leaves Mathura and goes to Dwarka. You know, if we see geographically, Mathura is in Uttar Pradesh. Dwarka is in faraway Gujarat. I don't think any Gopika would have ever nourished any ambition or hope of ever seeing Krishna in life again. But the Yadavas had him right, you know, by their side. So the Yadavas got nearness to Krishna. But what the Gopikas enjoyed was dearness to Krishna. The Gopikas were like those bees that are able to collect the nectar from the flower, while unfortunately the Yadavas, though they hopped around the flower, as Swami would compare the students to, you know, right, to be frogs around the lotus, they missed the essence, ambrosia that Krishna was. And that is why in the end, you know, what happens? They become drunken, they drink. And in that merrymaking, they start fight. War begins. It starts with Satyaki, one of the major warriors of the on the Pandava side.
Right. He's one of the main friends of Krishna.
Exactly. Right. A friend of Krishna from childhood days. Right. You know, Swami mentioned the story of Krishna, Balrama and Satyaki driving away a Rakshasa, a demon, right, in their childhood. He's a friend. And he's also a major warrior for the Pandavas. And one among the few who has survived the war. And there's Kritavarma, another great hero.
Right.
And it begins with Satyaki going and killing Kritavarma. Unimaginable. What happened? Both are noble people, and what happens? This shows what happens when you give up the Lord to indulge in the senses. When you indulge in the senses, when you let your senses go astray, indulging in your desires, giving up the Lord, it results in death. What the Gopikas did, if you see, it is totally different. They gave up their senses, they gave up food, water, they gave up all their pleasures in life to indulge in Krishna. Though they both started off same way, all this difference came because one gave up Krishna to indulge in the senses, one gave up the senses to indulge in Krishna. That has made the difference.
Probably, I mean, very beautifully put. In fact, that's exactly what happens with the Pandavas too. Hmm. You know, this incident, I think according to the Puranas, happens about three and a half decades after the Kurukshetra war is...
Yeah, about 35 years, correct. Huh.
You know, the moment this news of Krishna concluding his avatarhood reaches the Pandavas, suddenly the taste of victory just vanishes. You know, that victory which they have chased for so many years, you know, that being emperors of that realm which they had so much fought for, suddenly it just became tasteless. Because they realized that, you know, that very Lord was actually the one who is adding joy to their life. When that light goes out, what is the point of all this? That is the beautiful thing which I think probably all of us have to take in our life. You know, not necessarily in the physical sense, but in the sense that...
If God leaves...
If I am happy today, you know, you could be happy for anything. You could be happy with your success in professional life. You could be happy with your family life. I think we have to always remind ourselves it is because of this sweetener which is there in our life, which is Swami's presence.
Which should be the central pivot.
Right. And remind ourselves that this is what is actually making our life happy. And if that is in our mind, this prioritization will become so spontaneous. You don't have to consciously, you know, do that thing. And that's exactly what happens over and over again in the Pandava's life. You know, even when Arjuna goes to make that choice, he says, there is no dilemma in my mind. Because I have to choose Krishna. In any case, our choice is always going to be Lord Krishna.
You know, many have been the tales and stories that Swami has himself narrated of the Gopikas. Due to lack of time, maybe we'll not go into that now. We can possibly run an entire satsang on the glory of the Gopikas. But the difference between the Gopikas and Yadavas become very clear. Dear listeners, we will be coming back after this short break. You will now hear a song about these very Gopikas. And after this song, we will come back with the final devotee pair that we have picked for today's discussion. So, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Ni pedali madhu du grola
సాధువులు ద్రోలకున్నే ఆనాడి గోపికనే జనించితే నీ చెలిమి భాగ్యము నోమకున్నే అలనాటి లీలలు మరల చూడాలి ఆబాల గోపాలం వేచేనయ్యా
back, dear listeners, and we are discussing devotee pairs that seem to be very similar in every aspect, in their devotion and love towards Lord Krishna, or in their circumstances towards Lord Krishna, but how they ended up differently. The final pair we are going to discuss are two people, both of whom shared the privilege of being picked up by the Lord when they were born. Both were picked up by Lord Krishna when they were born. While one moved on towards redemption and glory, the other had a somewhat different ending. And the two people that I'm speaking about are Shishupala and Parikshit. You know, Shishupala was born with a few extra limbs. And it is said that when Shishupala was born, that donkeys began to bray and all ill omens were heard, and the mother knew that this is something really bad, something strange, something ugly. It is at that time that Lord Krishna, who had come for the ceremony, picks up the baby, and even as he picks up the baby, all these ill omens disappear and the extra limbs of the baby fall off. That is when the mother remembers the divine proclamation that when this happens, know that the person who is holding the baby will be the killer of the baby when it grows up. So that is the episode in which Lord Krishna happens to be the one to pick up Shishupala in his arms. If we see the other episode, we know Parikshit was a stillborn. That story Swami beautifully recounts. He says how the Brahmahastra released, the missile released by Ashwatthama, was directed towards the womb of Abhimanyu's wife, and therefore Parikshit, who is the child in the womb, is born as a stillborn. He is dead at birth, and while the Pandavas are wailing, Krishna goes and picks up the baby, and the baby begins to wail now, and the Pandavas begin to smile because life comes back into this baby. So both Parikshit and Shishupala had their beginning in life when Lord Krishna picked them up lovingly and fondled them. And yet we know how different their lives panned out to be. That is the final devotee pair we'll be discussing today.
Very true and interesting in the sense, like, you know, many of us oftentimes think, you know, I should have come earlier to Swami, or we kind of envy those people who are born in families which are devoted to Swami. And you know, we see pictures of Swami with, you know, children, you know, a little child on his lap. We often think that, oh, I should have come much earlier to Swami. You know, this particular pair which we speak of really breaks down that idea. It's not about when you come to Swami, or do you have the opportunity to come to Swami when you're young, or it finally is an action. It finally is in the choices that you make in life. It finally is in how you choose to live your life out. And that is why I think we must have mentioned this many, many times before, when Swami looked at a student and asked, what will you do for me? And that boy said, Swami, I'm ready to die for you. And Swami said, you know, what do I need people to die for me for? I want people to live for me. Because living is about making choices every day, every moment. At every turn of life, you have to make the choice and choose God and choose what is right.
And if you see Shishupala, what was the choice that he made? See, as I said, when Krishna picked up the baby, his arms fell off and the mother knew that Krishna is going to be the killer of Shishupala. So therefore, you know, she goes and prays to Krishna and says, Lord, if at all my child offends you, please forgive him. And Krishna in fact says, I will forgive him not once but 100 times. And now the mother is happy. She thinks that, I don't think that my son will offend the Lord 100 times. Is exactly what happens. If we see the life of Shishupala, he grows into one who envies the glory of Krishna, who feels offended by Krishna's rise and how much respect and love he receives. And therefore, when the Rajasuya Yagna?
Rajasuya Yagna, so, performed by Yudhishthira.
Yudhishthira, when that is being performed, and it is said the Agra Tambulam, the first mark of respect, who should be receiving it, and the Pandavas select Krishna to receive that. Everyone applauds it, even including people in the Kaurava camp, that is Bhishma, Drona. Though they are much elder to Krishna, they know that Krishna is deserving of that respect. But Shishupala gets up and he speaks very insultingly of Krishna. He says he is a lowly cowherd, worth, fit to be only under the cows, and what is he doing on the throne? And this is something that shocks everyone. In fact, different people get up and are on the verge of killing Shishupala. Where Bhima gets up and says, I will crush your skull, and Nakula is angry, Sahadeva is angry, even Bhishma says, you fool, you know, hold your tongue in rein. Otherwise, I will take out an arrow and finish you right away. And each one of them is capable of finishing Shishupala, but all of them, out of sheer respect to Krishna, they hold, because Krishna is just smiling, and he seems to be instigating Shishupala through his smile. You know, it is often said that one of the best forms of defense is just to keep silent and be smiling, because they can't bear it. An angry person wants to evoke an angry response from you, and if he is not able to do it, it frustrates him and angers him even more. And when this is happening, what is Shishupala doing? He is just keeping a count of how many times he has insulted Krishna, because he knows that his plan is, let me go till 90 and then stop. Let me insult Krishna to my heart's content and let me just stop. Because Krishna can't do anything to me. He is bound by the promises given to my mother. But anger is such a demon that it makes you lose all control. Before he knows it, Shishupala just exceeds his quota of 100. And till then, as Swami says in his discourse, Krishna is silent. The minute he exceeds 100, he does it even without knowing. Krishna just picks up the plate in which the Tambulam is kept and throws it. It gets converted into Sudarshan Chakra. And Shishupala, his neck is cut off, he is dead on the spot. But even as his soul arises, Krishna goes and allows the soul to merge into him. That is the Lord's compassion, that even though this person criticized him all his life, finally he got merger in him, because he was thinking of Krishna all the while, though in a negative sense. But, you know, that is not possibly a kind of life that we would love. This is what Shishupala did, because he criticized Krishna. He knew that his death is certain. Once he criticized him 100 times, that knowledge of death that he had, he utilized it to go away from Krishna, sadly.
Exactly, because whenever Swami would speak about Parikshit, you know, the thing which Swami would say is, here is a person who knew that his death is coming. These are two characters in the Mahabharata where two knew about their end and how they approached it. And Swami, whenever he says this, he would say that probably you don't know when you will die, but you are sure you're dying. Each one of you know that, you know, the only certain thing is that one day you have to die. And when you know that, why are you not approaching it like how Parikshit approached it? Because that's exactly how Swami would put him out as an example. Because here was this king who, you know, we all know that story. He goes into the forest one day for hunting. He's separated from his family. He's so thirsty. He goes into this
hermitage
where he sees this sage sitting in penance. He begs and pleads for water and there's no response. And then he takes a dead snake, puts it around the neck of the sage. Then the son of the sage comes. I think sage Sringi. Comes and, you know, seeing this plight of his father, he immediately curses that 7 days from now, the snake Takshaka will come and cause the death of this person who has done this. So later, you know, the father counsels his son that he's actually a very good king and you should go and tell him what you've done. But the moment Parikshit comes to know that, you know, he is already repenting for what he has done, but the moment he comes to know that this is his fate, he starts asking all his ministers and all his, you know, the intellectuals in his court, what should I do now? I have only 7 days. What am I to do? And that is when, you know, sage Sukha comes and he tells him that spend these 7 days in listening to the Bhagavatam. And in fact, whatever we speak today, whatever we have related today, is part of that Bhagavatam which actually Shuka Maharishi narrates to Parikshit. So, you know, what a beautiful life it is when he knew that 7 days is all that he has. Not only did he redeem himself, but he ensured that in the process he brings out this work of, you know, Bhagavatam, which will redeem the life of thousands and thousands of people who are going to follow. Because many, many times Swami would say that, you know, Bhagavatam Chadute, Bhagavatam.
Bhagavatam meaning you will become good.
Right, you will benefit out of it. So not only he did something which would benefit his 7 days and his, would glorify his death, but he did something which will benefit generations and generations that would follow.
Parikshit was lucky in that sense. At least he knew that he's got 7 more days to live. You and me have no guarantee. Right. We are here today. We don't know when. So even though he had a guarantee that he will live for 7 days, Parikshit utilized that to think of the Lord. When we have no guarantee, isn't it already too late for us to start thinking? Shouldn't we start immediately thinking of the Lord? That's a real intense thought to think about. But if we go back to comparing Shishupala and Parikshit, we realize the difference between them was, while one utilized the knowledge of his death to move towards the Lord, towards Krishna, one utilized the knowledge of his death to move away from the Lord. And we should always know that death is somewhere around the corner. We may not know when, but death is certain. And that knowledge of death we should utilize so that we move every day, every hour, every moment of our life closer to the Lord. In fact, that is one of my favorite prayers. I always say, Swami, let my love for you grow stronger every passing moment. How much I love you this moment, Swami, next moment let me love you more. Because I feel that alone is a life worth living, where every moment we go closer to the Lord, we love the Lord more than what we did the previous moment.
And even as we conclude this discussion, I'm just reminded of what once we had written to Swami in a card. I think must have been a Janmashtami card. It's really what, you know, we all feel, because I think one of the boys who were very good at Telugu had written that card. It said that, you know, Swami, we have heard that Krishna was very, very beautiful, but we don't know, we have not seen him. For us, nobody can be more beautiful than you. And we heard that when Krishna picked up that flute, you know, such melodious music flew, you know, poured out of it. You know, we don't know about that. We've not heard that music, but we know one thing for sure. You've touched our life and it has changed the way it has been so far. And that's all we can say, because, you know, when we hear all these stories of Lord Krishna, I think I can speak of for myself. I mean, before Swami came into the picture, yeah, it still filled us with joy, but we could not relate to these stories the way we can relate now, because we know Swami, we've been with Swami, we are living with Swami, and that is something we have to be eternally grateful for. And if that gratitude is remembered in our mind, I think everything else is taken care of. What we spoke about priority, what we spoke about belongingness, what we spoke about making the right choices, I think everything will fall into place if we believe that this was the greatest thing that happened to us.
Perfect. perfectly. On that note, with our deepest gratitude to Swami, offering ourselves at His lotus feet and praying to Him that our love for Him, our dedication for Him keeps growing stronger every passing moment, we conclude this afternoon satsang.
Sai Ram, you just heard an episode of our radio program, Afternoon Satsang. This is a segment of Radio Sai's Thursday Live, hosted by Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai at 12:30 PM Indian Standard Time on Thursdays, only on Asia Stream of Radio Sai Global Harmony. Today's episode was first broadcast live on 3rd September 2015. Dear listeners, we hope you like this program. As always, send us your feedback to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you, and Sai Ram from Prashanthinilayam.